JG3.
Number 5A.
Yes, I'd like to just refer quickly then to page 58 in a study aid for Max Kapler. Here we have the 8 ordered steps really to our oneness with being. This subject is found then in Kapler's book, The Ordered Approach to the One Being. It's a terrific subject, which really shows that one only ascends in consciousness because of the power descent causes us to go forward. So, therefore, in answering the question where we were here on the level of Christian Science about what would happen if we isolated that level alone, we were saying to ourselves it would be very pragmatic and that it would be a problem-solving mentality, always in a fix-it shop, so to speak. And another student, of course, said that, well, that doesn't sound like Christian Science in any way, or divine metaphysics, as it would be on the level of Christian Science, really because it's absolute Christian Science impact on the relative. One can see that it's a standpoint, really, of Christian Science, and in the 8 ordered steps to our oneness with being, where the steps go from metaphysics, as I mentioned, all is mental. Step 2, the mental can be good and evil. Step 3, thinking in terms of the ideas of the synonyms for God. Step 4, thinking in terms of the synonym for God. That's all thinking, that's metaphysics. When we come into science, it's really then the infinite one mind which is doing the thinking. And on step 5, the exercise is only the synonym of God in us can be one with the synonym of God. So only the mind which is God in us can be one with the mind of God. So therefore we can see that it is a standpoint of the divine mind, otherwise we'd be outside the one being. But any time we take a reductionist standpoint and say it's nothing but this or nothing but that, we lose the symphonic structure. We lose the scientific truthfulness of that level. And Max showed that very clearly then, as we see in his book, Truth and Scientific Truth. Any truth taken out of its structure can become a lie to the situation, can become an erroneous operation within the whole system. That's why we say we can't take anything out of context. These are levels that are interdependent. They relate on each other. If we isolate them, we wouldn't be working with truths anymore. They may be truths, but not scientific truths. There may be truths to metaphysics. A metaphysician, as Ellen said, wouldn't see anything wrong with being I've talked too long. Too many weeks here. On both coasts, I'm sorry. But we would become a pragmatist, and therefore the world wouldn't see anything wrong with that, would it, in ordinary metaphysics? But to us, it's not big enough because we see there are higher ways of doing things. All right, but that's a good explanation that Mary Jane gave. All right, so let's then see what, if we consider only the level of Christian Science and absolute Christian Science and disregard the other levels. All right? Let's first of all say what would happen if we just isolated the absolute Christian Science level. What would we have if we only calculated in ideas, in positive values? What would we lose? Application to the human, the impact on the human, definitely, the resolving of error. It'd be like the three monkeys of hear no evil, see no evil, speak no evil, the absolutism, all right? What about the higher levels? What would we lose if we didn't have absolute Christian, divine science and Christian Science, if we just isolated absolute Christian Science? Okay? That's good, Charlie. All right. We certainly wouldn't have any sense of oneness or universality. There'd be no universal treatment. There'd be no universal salvation. There'd be no real day of rest. We'd always be calculating, calculating, calculating. I guess we would really like to get out of that sense of always feeling we have to do it. We have to do the calculating and let the universe solve its own problems. All right. That's a good answer. Then we see that, that's good, okay. What, if we isolated just the divine science level from all the other levels, what would we have? All right, could be mysticism. Is that Janice? Is that you saying that? Louisa. It'd be mysticism and why, Louisa? Mm-hmm. Isolated. We just took it as a nothing but theory. Mysticism means, oh, it's one of our questions here. We can answer it now. What is, let's look at point five because it's more or less explaining it here. What is the difference between science and mysticism? If we isolate the divine science level, why might there just be mysticism? What is mysticism? All right, an unexplained oneness. That's good, Mary Jane. Because, yes. No differentiation? Okay. Good. That's good. Good. And I guess that's why, Chris, that they couldn't bring forth the science in the Eastern world before the Western world. The Western world brought it forward because of the Aristotelian logic really allowed us to order, didn't it, in our symbols and everything. It allowed our symbols were so exact and differentiated that we could say this comes a one comes before a two comes before a three before a four before a five, six, or seven. But in the Eastern world, their symbols meant so many different things that it was very difficult for a science to evolve as it did in the Western world so rapidly. All right, so science requires differentiation, certainly not just being sucked up into an undifferentiated whole. Amorphous generally means an amorphous whole with no differentiation, no categories. I guess I would say so, wouldn't it? It just kind of a, like we have it then. Mysticism would be just this amorphous whole, huh? Already religion is better because it's working with truth, but we see science is the scientific truth is a point of intersection within a larger frame of reference, and we can't take it out, can we? But mysticism, yes, that's all good, everything you're saying. And what's the danger of mysticism? It brings forth no science. We tend to feel we would lose our identity, and the danger then would be the union of opposites. We would get that sugar-coated dualism of the yin-yang, huh? It's all together one. You know, they have it all into one. You'd have your good and evil, your right and wrong, all lumped together, wouldn't we? And so, therefore, we would see doesn't differentiate out. This is good, this is evil, this is right, this is wrong. It's a union mystico. All right. Well, that's very good. So that took care of point five. I think we generally understand this ascending and descending business. I think you've got it. Okay. Well, that's great. Well, that was a good exercise. All right. So let's take a look then at the impact that such a study would have on world consciousness. And this, we can have a little fun here now. It's always fun to see where the world is. All right, so the impact of multidimensional thinking on the world. Well, it's been around. You can never really isolate these concepts. People have thought about these things, but basically it goes against the classical logic of Aristotle. Poor Aristotle, he's accused of everything, and the poor man did a lot of good. his Aristotelian logic is there's nothing wrong with it. It brought us out of the caveman thinking out of the magical age, out of the mystical age, out of the mythological age, into the scientific age. Without his books on logic and reasoning, we wouldn't have gone as far as we have, certainly with the rebirth of the Greek classics in the Renaissance around the 1500s. We needed this Aristotelian logic, as Chris said so rightly. It gave us the ability to differentiate, and with differentiation you get orders, and with invariable orders we get laws. We never could have entered the age of laws of Newton without the Aristotelian logic. But as we move on, we've come out of the Newtonian worldview, and its basic premises of working with this Aristotelian logic, and into the Einsteinian worldview of a multidimensional transclassical logic. So just in a brief nutshell, the classical Aristotelian logic is such as we know that something is something and it can't be something else. Therefore, A is A, and it certainly can't be B or C or D. But we know that in the multidimensional transclassical logic, that A can be A, it can be B, it can be C, it can be D, yet still remain A. If we look at it from the standpoint that A is seen from many different dimensions, it takes on many different forms, yet still remains A. So multidimensional logic is what goes on. And in the little book, as we love, of Flatland by Abbott, we can't talk about dimensions without Abbott. And certainly when we read these books on superstring theory and extradimensionality or hyperspace or the Kaluza-Klein theory, however we want to talk about extradimensional thinking, Abbott is always referred to in these books. How many have read Abbott, The Flatland? Oh, get it. It's so good. It just reads like it's just a little teeny skinny book. It was written in 1883 as a short science fiction thinking, and it's just plain fun. It's delightful. It's just it's a whimsical story, and it has made such impact that theoretical physicists still quote from it. It's just fun. It came out at the time, of course, Mrs. Eddy was working with multidimensional reasoning in the spiritual realm. Well, in there, Abbott talks about the different points of dimensions of thinking. He has a point lander where there is working out from no dimensions. He has a line lander who can think only in one dimension, linear thinking. He has a flat lander who can only think in two dimensions. He has a space lander who can only see in three dimensions. And in there, he shows that we can begin with a point, which is no dimension, and if we move that point in one direction, we create a line, one dimension, and if we spin a line around its midpoint, we create a circle, a two dimension, and if we spin a circle on its axis, we create a sphere, the third dimension. So he began to show there that of course, a one dimension can't perceive what a two dimension looks like, and a two dimension can't perceive what a three dimension looks like, but a three dimension certainly includes the second and first. So this is therefore the way we are seeing today what the physicists see. And this is just building up the subject for our appreciation of dimensional thinking that's happening in the world today and the discovery of these other dimensions beyond just the three. That such is that in Max's book on the oneness of being, yes, I believe that's where this one is coming from, his book on the oneness of being, the Christian Science textbook. It's the chapter, Some Objections Answered, chapter 11. You will see this little diagram in there, and this is just a photocopy from his book. And there he shows that we have this well-known thought puzzle, And there we have, he said, is the object is to connect all nine dots by four continuous straight lines without lifting the pencil or retracting any line. And for the audio tape audience, we can see that we have on a piece of paper, we put 1, 2, 3 dots on a line. And then we, below that, we put 1, 2, 3 dots on another line. And below that, 1, 2, 3 dots on another line. And the object then is how to connect all nine dots by four continuous straight lines without lifting the pencil or retracting any line. So we could put it down on our paper and we say, well, let's see, what do we do here? Do we go here? See, we can't lift in any way. You see, we want to figure it out. Well, if we did it and if we had time to do it, we see that some way, if we stay within this frame of reference, we have to keep lifting our pencil in order to hook them all together. You can try it later. But in order not to lift the pencil and to continue right on hooking all straight lines together, one has to go outside the frame of reference. One has to go from the line, let's take the dot in the lower left here. You have to move straight on up and outside of the third dot for point two. You come down to the lower right for a point three, back over to one, and then out to four. You can connect all the dots without lifting your pen or pencil. So Max says there that the same method applies to the solution of our ordinary day-to-day problems. Instead of letting ourselves be bound by the narrow human frame of reference, thinking that the solution must always be found within its given limits, we must look beyond these limited human conceptions. The more we approach problems from a larger frame of reference, the more we gain new perspectives and measure things by different aims and values. Then the individual problem is put in its proper context, and a solution emerges which we were previously unable to see. So we know that ourselves, when we put our problems often in a larger context, then we can see how to heal that individual tree. We usually can't see the forest for the trees, huh? And so, therefore, he says, choosing the right frame of reference. Thus, solving a problem is not a matter of examining the problem itself, but of first putting it into a larger frame of reference. Letting this larger context determine the real place value of the problem in our life. The only frame of reference which provides a right perspective for all problems is the divine system of reference. Only from this divine whole can the actual importance of a problem be rightly judged. So already in our only everyday life, we see that in solving a problem, that usually by putting it, as we see, as he said, into that larger frame of reference and letting that larger context determine the right place value of our problem, then we get the right perspectives of it. And I think we all know that. We get too close to our problems. We make too much of reality of them. We paint the devil on the wall, so to speak. If we get away from them and look back, things don't look so bad as we thought. So this is more or less the basis for extra-dimensional thinking. It solves problems. The Bible alludes to the fact that they had to go outside the camp to find him, meaning we had to go outside the system of reference to get the answer to the problem within the camp. We know then always those people who've had the comprehensive view of reality were the ones who were in control. Bucky Fuller was very keen on this in his book, Operating Manual for Spaceship Earth, that it's those who had the holistic general concept of the world were the leaders. For example, in the early days, he said, the people who had to stay home and work the farm were more or less the one-dimensional, two-dimensional consciousness that had to reduce their life to the nothing but reductionist world. Their world was nothing but the farm. And the ones who can control these, the ones in the nothing but the farm reductionist mentality, because reductionism means to reduce everything down to just one dimension, and that one dimension becomes the nothing but reality. Reality is nothing but the farm. And then the danger is that you generalize that and say that all that is ever going on in the whole universe is my farm, huh? Well, the Bucky said that to the those pirates that went out, and they went out in the seas and went from land to land, that they got the comprehensive view of things. They knew there was more to life than just the farm, so to speak. And they came back with their riches and golds, and they controlled the farmer, you see. So he was always meaning that the comprehensivist controlled the specialist, in that if one over-specialized, it would lead to extinction. That's the same thing in our work. If we reduce science down to just nothing but this pet's theme of, let's say, we're really hot on the science order, on the Christian Science level, and we just make that our pet theme, and we decide, oh, well, then I'm going to see that all science has nothing to do but the science order. You see the danger? It would quickly lead to extinction, because the whole model of being is a comprehensive network of relationships of much more than just the science order. So we have to watch out for this reductionist viewpoint, and that's what dimensional thinking does. It keeps us from being reduced down to nothing but one dimensional view of things, or it keeps it from being reduced down to nothing but the two-dimensional view. It keeps it from being reduced down to nothing but the three-dimensional view. We could say, well, we're real happy with the third dimension. Why are these physicists talking to us about the fourth dimension? Now, Einstein's work is still in the third dimension. He was working with a third dimension, and his coordinating factor was the fourth dimension, was time, not space. So he was working with time as a coordinating factor of the third dimension in his fourth dimensional space-time continuum. When Einstein wanted to hook together all that he was finding out within that spectrum of the laws of gravitation, the laws of electromagnetism, the strong and weak nuclear forces, he wanted to hook these forces together within this fourth dimensional space-time continuum, and we know that he went on still greatly disappointed. But at his time, somebody called Kaluza and Klein came along, and they gave to Einstein, they sent to him a paper, because he was one of the big thinkers of the day. They sent a paper to him saying, well, we can solve your problem of the grand unified field theory of the law of gravity and the law of electromagnetism and the strong and nuclear force by appealing to the fifth dimensional mathematics. Well, Einstein didn't want anything to do with it, because he said, he could see that that was going to, that's something beyond what he gave. So for about, in these books they say for about many, many years he held down the paper and didn't publish it until he couldn't do it any longer and finally sent it off to a publisher. Where nowadays this Kaluza-Klein theory takes on the meaning of the hyperspace theory, or what they have today called the superstring theory. Those are all hyperspace or Kaluza-Klein theory or superstring theories are all the same concept, alluding to that there are other dimensions beyond just our own dimension. Hyperspace, extra space. Or they would talk about these extra dimensions, because they have so many different dimensions, not only the fifth spatial dimension and the sixth spatial dimension. There is the seventh spatial dimension, or an eighth spatial dimension, or a ninth spatial dimension, or a tenth spatial dimension, which they talk about. We even see alluded to 11th spatial dimensions that their mathematics allow to happen. So they know that the mathematics, one physicist said today that they are touching 21st century mathematics today, and they don't know what to do with them, that it's often what they see in their calculations are very impractical for today because they can't make it practical, that we haven't the technology to put it into practice, what they see in the calculating mathematically. So what they see in extra dimensionality, we can say to ourselves, well, that's not very practical. How can I get to the fifth, sixth, seventh, eighth, ninth, and tenth dimension? I'm limited here on the third. Well, the physicists say the same thing. How are they going to get there? They don't know, but they see it. They see it in their calculations, you see. So, therefore, this Kaluza-Klein theory of hyperspace or superstring theory of that allows at least 10 dimensions to exist is there. We can't ignore it. Physicists are showing it to us.